You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. Growing up, the term privilege meant somebody who drove in a brand new car, probably went to the best schools, vacationed abroad during the summers, and lived in a really nice house. That term has either been expanded or altered drastically over the last few decades to mean something entirely different today. And then joining me as my guest is Carrie Lucas, the president of the Independent Women's Forum in Washington, D.C. Her new book is Checking Progressive Privilege. We'll be talking about what that really means. Who's responsible for putting this in motion? Who's it affecting here in this country? And what is it doing to our society? Carrie, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That description I gave, and I'm going back, I'm talking about late 50s, early 60s. It's kind of, that would be my interpretation. But today, progressive privilege means something entirely different, does it not?
Yeah. Well, what I did in this book is looked back at some of the modern conversation about privilege and really how our understanding of this term changed. Today I think sometimes you almost have, it's become the butt of a joke because people have gone so far in trying to use the term privilege almost as a weapon. But back when the modern conversation about who is privileged and what privileged means really began in the late 1980s, and I thought it was really interesting. There was a woman named Peggy McIntosh who was a women's studies professor, and she was frustrated with kind of the way that women were being shortchanged in the university system around her. But as she was kind of in the process of trying to write about and explain how men were being privileged over women, she started becoming aware of how, as a white person, she was privileged compared to black professors who were in her town and in this university system. And what she did is she started a list of she said just of things that she observed and ways that she was privileged in her everyday life compared to others. And it was things like, I open up a text to my children's textbook and I see mostly people of my race and I see examples of a culture that is my heritage. Going into the store and finding Band-Aids that roughly match your skin color or baby dolls that roughly match the skin color of your kids. Things like that and more, more serious things. Things like she described, when I go into a grocery store and if I've forgotten my checkbook, the sales clerk believes me and assumes that I truly did just forget my checkbook, where if I was a minority, they might think that something else was going on. And she describes she describes it as a knapsack of privileges that she gets to carry around that others don't. And I found it actually very compelling. I think you could imagine this in the late 1980s as a reality and see the purpose and the kind of the why one sought to kind of awaken to this privilege and recognize that we needed to have a more inclusive society. So I think it's worth kind of going back and remembering what the origins of that conversation was.
I too remember that period, and I can probably less so up here in New England. I think it was actually let me get back to what I was saying. Racist comments, as you were talking about, as I was listening to you, Band-Aids being, I don't think most people even realize this was consciously done. I mean, is that fair to say that there was almost a conscious effort to say, look, white people, men and women in this country, come first and nobody else. But that's taken itself up to another notch. It's become even more pervasive today, and it's infiltrated the political system. I think it's gotten to the point where it's we've really fractionalized this country. I think there's just no longer just Democrats and Republicans. If you have any kind of an opposing comment, if you have any kind of an opposing view on something, someone has a label to put on you. Does that fall under the umbrage of progressive privilege?
So if you think of the whole concept of privilege, I thought was interesting because obviously it is very different. And I think back, you know, the whole idea was that you don't have to be actively discriminatory. You don't have to say, I think the one said the group of people is better than the other, but that society did all of these things to make some groups seem normal and like what is good and kind of the default in our culture. And that was that's a real privilege. And you know, in the last 30 years since this concept kind of came about, we've obviously moved much more to be an inclusive society. Now you turn on the TV and you see, you don't just see white people, you see all different people. You don't just see heterosexual couples now depicted. You often see gay or single people or gay couples. This is become much more commonplace. But it's funny, so I write about in this little book I wrote about how this kind of change in how the whole concept of privilege. But there's one place where really we haven't checked this kind of privilege. You know, if we've been checking white privilege and male privilege and heterosexual privilege in this one area, ideology, we've actually gone very much in the other direction. Progressive privilege isn't a term that anyone had really used before. That's why I started looking around, and I went, and when I was in the course of writing this book, I looked around and had much like Peggy. I tried to model after the woman, the Peggy McIntosh, and tried to observe what I see as progressive privilege in my own daily life. And it is things like if you turn on a drama show, you're very likely to have something with a progressive theme and where kind of the progressive worldview is presented as normal. If you turn on an awards show, you know, you're supposed to just be seeing some celebrities get awards. You're going to be lectured on progressive causes. If you open up textbooks, you're given a progressive point of view. Fashion magazines, you go to, you know, find out about the latest lipstick color, and you're very likely to see very glamorizing articles about Democratic members of Congress, and conservatives will be absent. They'll be ignored, just like other groups used to be ignored in places like fashion magazines, or they'll be made fun of. Very often, conservatives are just denigrated in things like fashion magazines. And so I tried to put this in the context of something we knew was wrong. We know it wasn't fair and inclusive and good to when we only presented white people, and it should be similarly. We should recognize that it isn't fair or inclusive or creating a better, fairer society if it's just progressive ideology that's given a platform.
I think Fox News, because they're probably the only true conservative media outlet in the country, talks about that almost on a daily basis, that, you know, they're the minority. And as you said, the progressive thinking, progressive folks who follow that progressive ideology are not letting any other voice in. I don't know how true that is. I mean, you have this on your radar screen more than I do. But what was this, Karen? I guess the question is, where did this all come from? Was it the race issues that we had in the 60s? Was it Vietnam? Was it just the culmination of things? And it was just, you know, that train kept building up steam, and it was coming, and nobody really wanted to admit that we would be where we are today.
You know, I think that's a really interesting question and kind of interesting to take a step back from. And first, you're right that there certainly are. You know, I get this sometimes when I present this, they say, hey, what about Fox News? You know, obviously there are some, and it's very true. There are some very explicitly conservative shows, some conservative, radio programs, television programs. There's lots of conservative content online, but it's explicitly conservative. That's when we're talking about politics. I think what's more kind of important to become aware of and is less understood is the things like the culture stuff that isn't explicit. It's not anti-conservative, but it's creates that those expectations. It's things like the fact that in university you often have zero professors that are Republicans. If that was any other, if that was another minority group, if there was no gay professors, if all professors were white and Christian, you would certainly say in a university system, wow, that's really a limited perspective. That's strange, and that's probably not appropriate or not healthy to have so few different types of role models and perspectives. But on ideology, that's become the norm. But on the question of why, how that happened, you know, I really think that this is, if you kind of go back to kind of the beginning of this political correctness and this idea that we had to be careful, obviously being considered a racist or a bigot or something along those lines is a tremendously powerful, and it's the thing that most people, it's the last thing you'd want to be called. It's one of the worst insults that you can hurl upon someone. And we've really been defining or kind of spreading how you can define a racist or what you have to do to avoid have those labels. And I think that's grown so much. And with the kind of control that was given in of schools and textbooks and much of the culture to some folks who really embraced the progressive kind of PC culture and this idea, they've been consistently defining anything that is conservative, anything that is not kind of on the social justice, progressive ideology. They've been creating things that define anything outside of that as bad or as abnormal, as, heaven forbid, racist, sexist, bigoted in some way, and making it so everybody is kind of moving in the other direction. And frankly, I think this more than anything explains what, the progressives out there wonder why we got Donald Trump and are so, aghast at how much support there is for President Trump. This is a big reason why, and I think it's a lot of it was because pushing back on this.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think that he's certainly not afraid to say what's on his mind, and he throws it out there, and it really gets under a lot of people's skin. I mean, I hear this daily, across all. It's not just young people. It's as you said, it's really a mixed bag. I want to take a quick pause, and then we'll be right back. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. My guest this week is Carrie Lucas, the president of the Independent Women's Forum in Washington, D.C. Her new book, Checking Progressive Privilege, we're talking about the best way of describing it, Carrie, would be the marginalizing of a conservative ideology, which was kind of mainstay in this country, two, three, four, five decades ago, completely changed, as you said, today. But I guess the thing that bothers me, and I think it bothers a lot of people, is that you can't give your point of view if it's in total opposition to someone else's anymore. I remember being able to have debates. We had debates in grammar school and high school. In fact, they encouraged that. No longer. And as you said, college campuses, I think you're right. I would venture to say, what college campus in this country has any conservatives, on the payroll? Very few. So, you can't be. I don't think you can have a well balanced country society unless you have all viewpoints. So, does this mean that this is the end of conservative voice?
No, and the funny thing is, I think that when we talk about this, I'm using kind of the language of this as being a minority. But the thing that's one of the things that you can tell is most out of whack is actually conservatives aren't really a minority. I mean, there's the country is very evenly divided. About a third of people associate themselves with kind of liberal or progressive causes. About a third associate themselves with conservative causes, and a third consider themselves independents. So that progressives are not a majority of this, what you see on television and what you see in Hollywood and the Academy Awards and in New York City and the people who control, the AP and the kind of big parts of our mainstream press, they all are progressive, but that's not a reflection of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think this really does have big implications. You hear people who said things that, they didn't know anybody who was for voting for Trump. If you are in the media or you are in a cultural institution and you didn't have one person who would admit that they were voting for Trump, that means you have a very undiverse, you haven't been, you really have a very closed view and are really in an echo chamber. Because I think, most of us out there, of course we knew people who supported Trump, just as we knew people who supported Hillary Clinton. But I think that some of the kind of the elites, the cultural elites, have really isolated themselves. And I think from a Republican and a conservative perspective, there was so much frustration for years that there were, that a lot of the leadership, men like George Bush and Mitt Romney, obviously great people. These were, very kind, polite people, and who believed in, had their views, but very much believed in civil discourse. But as a part of that, they seemed to almost accept or be resigned to this idea as, hey, conservatives are always going to be tarred as racist, and that's just kind of how it is, and it's our job to try to, be as nice as we can and show that we're not, show how nice we are, but not fight back. And I think there were so many people who were so sick of that, that that's when they came back. President Trump obviously not only, was very outspoken on his own views, but he seems to get conservatives back and say, like, hey, that's not racist, I'm just talking, and try to break down this idea of that you have to walk on eggshells. And, obviously there's things that President Trump says that I wish he would be more careful with. I don't think it's appropriate. I do believe in civil discourse, and he certainly doesn't always follow those rules. But, man, I understand as a conservative that it's nice to have somebody who doesn't seem absolutely terrified of what the New York Times is going to say,
right,
or what somebody's going to call him. I think that's, people should be aware of that. Liberals and those who are kind of creating, really, who have really been, discriminating against, and I do think it's truly discrimination. It's been a lot of putting down and marginalizing, but truly trying to make other in a way that's very kind of mean. Anybody who's outside of their ideology, they helped create the forces that led to Donald Trump. And if they want to have more moderate Republicans or more kind of civil conversations, then they need to start treating people, including conservatives, more kindly or more just, with some respect, giving them space to talk. Otherwise, you're going to get people who are fighting, like Donald Trump, because conservatives feel like they need it.
Right. I think that's very true. I think there's as you said, that this divisiveness has caused people to feel that they have their back up against the wall. As I'm listening to you talk, I remember attending an event last fall when I think you're probably just as aware of it as I am. A number of very high profile athletes. Whether it had to do with the allegiance to the flag or just before sporting events, it took that to that forum, 100,000 people at a football game, at a basketball game, a baseball game, whatever it may be, and I happened to make a comment. And it was a mixed crowd, young, old, minorities, non-minorities, so it was a very balanced group of people at this particular event. And I remember one lady came up to me and she says, are you opposed to somebody having a voice? I said, well, no, but, they're getting millions of dollars to play sports. I think they can, if they want to talk about politics or their political views, don't use that sporting event. And she was outraged. That I was racist.
That's awful.
You're right when you say you're fearful of being able to say anything anymore. So what do you do?
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because I think that I'm all for people having civil, respectful, but robust, and you could hard-hitting debates about policy, but without losing the kind of the perspective that the person who's debating with you is also a human being, and they almost always want the best for the country, for their families, for other people's families. I think that obviously there's still people with prejudices, and it's not a perfect world, but those are fringes. Those are fringes on the left and fringes on the right who are kind of bad actors. So we should we should get over this, or not try to kind of demonize the other side so much, and that's something we need to work on in the left and the right. But also, you're totally right. Let's get politics back in its place. There used to be that kind of wisdom or the old kind of polite advice that you don't talk about politics or religion at a party or at a dinner party. And I think there's something to that there's times to debate politics, but there's also things that aren't political. Not everything has to be political. Not every shoe advertisement has to become a huge political fight. Not every football game. A lot of people turn on football because they want to escape from all that. They don't want to watch any more of the kind of divisive news. And the same with there's so many folks out there who want to, you turn on Hollywood movies or you go to, you like these celebrities, you like them because of you know, the great things they've been able to do. And there may be times for them to give their political opinions, but it really shouldn't be when they're giving an award for some film they produced, they appeared in. They shouldn't try to lecture us about their kind of views on politics. It's just, it's become so hard to escape. And I don't think it's making things better. I think it's really is just making things worse and making it so politics seems to have crept into every part of our lives.
As you were talking, I'm thinking of trying to put Maddow and Hannity in the same room. Can you imagine? I think there would be an all-out brawl. I mean, I think I think they would get into a physical confrontation. But it goes back. You know, we're joking about it here, but you're right. I mean, so what is that? I hear this even from people who supported Trump, think, geez, I wish he'd back off a little bit. As you said, you know, perhaps he feels he has his back against the wall. But Washington itself, Carrie, there is just such discord. The issues, in other words, nobody is doing the job they were sent there to do. It's become, let's attack, let's outmaneuver the other side. So my question to you is, you know, how long can this go on before this really starts to affect, this country in a way where, you know, those who hate us, and I'm talking about enemies outside this country, will take full advantage of that?
Yeah, you know, I think that we've still, you know, we're still at the core a great country and with a common cause. I think that most people recognize that there is something good and worth preserving. You know, it's funny, it's hard to know how to kind of roll this back. I think that a real problem has been that social media, especially Twitter, but kind of more platforms, we've encouraged so much politics to happen in this virtual space where we've lost kind of the norms of decorum. You know, I think that if you actually did put some of these kind of true enemies in a room, they probably would end up, you know, they would have a lot to argue about, but they'd also find some stuff that they like about each other. You know, I find, I worked at some polls and kind of volunteered, I found that I really enjoyed my time talking with the people who were volunteering at the Democratic side. And yes, you know, we didn't agree on politics. We didn't agree on who we wanted to get election, but they were really nice to my kids when I brought my kids along. You know, they had kids of their own. We talked about things like that. There was so much we had in common, even in the fact that we both were showing up and in the rain because we cared enough to do so. Right. They were very respectful to me. I wish that more of that, because then you get on Twitter and everybody just becomes, you know, it's not a person anymore. It's just a handle and somebody you can very easily attack in ways you would never, ever do to somebody's face when you realize this is a nice person with a family and, you know, I hate to say, you know, with feelings. And so I think that's been a real problem. And I don't know how we pull that back, but I think it's something that everybody needs to think about is, you know, how to make it so less of our kind of these cultural debates are happening with that kind of brutal anonymity that kind of dominates today.
I think, and I don't want to go off track here, and you know, we haven't got that much time left anyway, but you're exactly right. The Twitters and this, you know, the social media platforms. You know, I remember you probably remember this as well. You know, the bully pulpit. You know, from the turn of the century, this has really become those who would never ever voice an opinion, as you said, in a mixed crowd, now feel empowered to the point where perhaps not so much you and I, because we didn't, you know, we weren't born or weaned on technology. Yeah, we have to go along to get along, but I'm fearful that millennials and future generations, this is how they'll discuss politics, and it will become a real, you know, a war of words, to the point where, you know, as you said, trying to find that link, that common ground, can no longer be achieved. Am I overplaying it?
No, absolutely. You know, and I think there's also because now we've almost moved into two separate camps. It's really hard for, I think, people to have news sources that they trust. And it's important. You know, we know, I know that there's certainly some guys on who are conservative, Republican, who end up being bad guys, who break the rules or are mm-hmm. unethical. And you need sources of, like, concrete sources of information that are going to kind of let you know that and say, hey, you thought you were rooting for this guy, but actually this guy's, you know, he's not good. He's doing bad things. He needs to be held to account. You need to get rid of him. We need that. We need that that on both sides of the aisle. And right now, I think there has been, you know, as we move, you know, I don't know. Can't, like, the New York Times, I feel like, is so incredibly biased, not just in their opinion columns, but really throughout. And I see things that I know something about that they cover where I think, gosh, you know, you guys don't know what you're talking about. And you just are so one-sided. So, but that's, and that's bad because, you know, I should be able to trust the New York Times. I want to be able to trust the New York Times, but I don't.
Right.
And, you know, I think you found that in the coverage. I think the coverage with Trump, the media, some of those old kind of trusted sources of media have become so crazy. Everything he does is not just, hey, that was an inappropriate thing to say. It's, this is, you know, this is the worst thing that's ever happened.
Right, right.
They're just so crazy that I think they need to kind of start to pull that back and remember that, you know, their job is to kind of be an umpire, tell the facts as they are, and not be so easily try to make everything into you know, a crisis.
Right.
I worry a little bit that that's, you know, the market may be at work here, and that, you know, you're rewarded for creating a crisis and not for response reporting the facts. But hopefully conversations like this are a way to start and, you know, raising awareness about how this is making everything worse. And it's bad for progressives. I mean, my goodness, it's certainly been terrible for some of those mainstream media outlets.
Yeah, it's a good way you put it, though, that the you know, this is becoming a marketing tool, and it's the only tool that they seem to feel you know, can get them where they got to go. And that's just not the right way to, that wasn't the role of the media. Again, the book is Checking Progressive Privilege. The author is my guest this week has been Carrie Lucas, the president of the Independent Women's Forum. And Carrie, just real quick before we close out this evening, people want to post questions, just get more information about, you know, about this topic, the book itself, where might they reach you?
Yeah, please come to IWF.org. That's the Independent Women's Forum. You've got our website there. You can get the book, and you can also see examples of progressive privilege. We have a whole section of the website kind of dedicated to that. But then we cover a lot of other issues from education to healthcare to you know, taxes, the economy. So please come check us out there.
And the discussion this evening has centered on just being fair and honest, you know, opposing views, certainly are welcomed, regardless of where you stand on issues, but, you know, not to demonize someone else because they have a different point of view. And I think Carrie's laid out a way that can be achieved and what's really going on. So we're thankful for that. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose questions, comments, feedback to me directly. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.